So all the heavy lifting today, empirically, has been done already, and it's just left for me to engage you in the fight, because that's really what public health is about, right? We fight for the rights of those who are most in need in society. So by way of, first of all, thank you for the three-section collaboration. We were hoping that the place would be filled with hundreds of people, so I'm learning how difficult it is to penetrate this huge media circus that goes on here every year at the public health meeting. The theme this year is wonderful because it's healthography, which really points to variation in regional practice patterns, med use in general, and for us here, a continuing reminder that where we live or where we practice or where we receive treatment really matters. So I'm going to do two things with your permission. First, I'm going to walk you through quickly my experience through the history of pharmacoepidemiology. And then second, pose three questions in which I want your help in coming up with a range of solutions, at least working efforts to try to keep calling attention to the needs of our most vulnerable children who are the Medicaid population. Pharmacoepi is the study of prescription meds in large community-based populations. We use big data sets. In the years since I left graduate school in 1984, pharmacoepi has developed quite rapidly. 25 years is nothing in the history of science. And we've staked out an area called post-marketing surveillance. Well, I want you to think about the stakeholders in this game. There's Big Pharma. There's the FDA, whose authority has increased enormously since 2002 in its role in pediatric drug evaluation. Legislation like BPCA, PREA, and FDASIA, and I'm not going to translate all of those, but to assure you that we have made some progress in getting the FDA engaged around pediatric patients as a subgroup of those who get evaluated. Then there's the health insurance industry, both public and private insurers. They oversee the formulary decisions, and they essentially help us understand whether you will or you will not get access to a given med. These decision makers control 18% of the GDP, which is more than $3 trillion a year. So follow the money, folks, and you will understand why post-marketing issues are an ever increasingly important issue. And I just came from that session with Steffi Woolhandler and Gordy Schiff, who was, extolling the continuing gaps and horrific experience, and all against continuity of care, which is where we are. And I haven't even mentioned prescribing doctors. I haven't mentioned pharmaceutical scientists and the economists and pharmacoeconomists. And I haven't said a word about patients. All of us patients relying very heavily, both physically and psychologically, on the trust of our physicians to provide us with information that's going to help us with the clinical decision that is in our best interest. Stakeholders notwithstanding, a lot of the credit for the growth of pharmacoepi has really been due to the IT people, the computer geeks. They've made computing the capacity that was unthinkable in 1980 when I started graduate school, and now today we have huge systems dedicated to analyzing millions of records that come from health insurers. And even the term big data, you hear it everywhere now. Everybody's into big data. Then finally, the third big element in all of this is methodology, because we went to epidemiology to help us understand how to measure drug exposure, the duration of use, the cumulative milligrams exposure, and things like this. And to do that in a population-based model, which means, what's my denominator, right? Epidemiologists spend enormous amount of time helping us understand the difference between measuring it this way or measuring it that way. Well, we did a lot of work over the last 20 years on new metrics, like measuring prevalence of use, which Susan showed you a minute ago, and new user designs, which Dr. Cooper and Dr. Bobo's the example showed you, and of course their mentor, Wayne Ray, one of the founding fathers, pioneering founders of pharmacoepi in the United States, has developed. And that helps us to get a much clearer picture of the linkage between a drug exposure and an outcome. And to control, we've done a lot of work with multivariable analysis and confounders. And some data sets, like the Medicaid-insured population of children, has helped us to shed light on subgroups that differ in the extent and severity of their economic and social needs, as well as their medical needs. Dr. Dosri showed us the intricate patterns of new use of antipsychotics among foster care kids, the most vulnerable of our populations. And her findings generate compelling questions about why atypical antipsychotics are being used in so many foster care children for behavioral, non-psychotic conditions for which the evidence base is slim to none. So now I'm going to move to my three questions for you to help me figure out what we should be thinking about in pediatric psychopharm. The first question is, what do we need to know about pediatric psychopharm in community populations? It's important to recall some history. You know, until 15 years ago or so, prescription drugs have really largely been evaluated in adults, and then after we get some experience with them, family docs then feel more confident to try it in an adolescent or a younger age child. This tradition is a very long-standing one. It goes by the name off-label use. FDA says it's a sacred medical tradition. We shouldn't interfere with it because sometimes you find serendipitously some great thing, right? Some great accident of fate. What is off-label use? According to FDA, they say, well, you're using it for an indication for a condition for which there is really inadequate evidence, or we're using it in an age group that's below the age in which it's been evaluated before. So again, taking Dr. Dosri's example of atypicals, you know, they've approved for use for treatment-resistant depression in adults. Well, not in those less than 16, but we find a good deal of combination use, starting with an antidepressant and then as you move on down the road. And by the way, you know, those TV ads you've seen are for adults when your own antidepressant isn't enough. That's what they want you to. So we're selling that as a message, which should should concern you as much as it does me, because I could throw a shoe at the TV when I see something like that. It trivializes really, really powerful stuff. So, let me move on here. What pharmacoepi has done for us is by providing these patterns, big picture patterns, global use across the country or within a state, looking at the regional variation across a state, is now it takes it away from anecdote or, you know, small amount of evidence that we think something is being done, to saying, here's the evidence, here's the extent of use, right? When I say something is three times more likely in this population than in that, and it's not really a rational decision behind that, it gives us the opportunity to be banging on some door or other to say, we have to do something about this because we're not convinced that long-term exposure is going to be safe and effective in this kid. My second question is, how safe is that prescription drug? You know, when 1962 federal legislation made efficacy a new standard for drug evaluation, everybody got excited. But the lay public really has made the assumption that if the drug is marketed, it means it's passed that efficacy and safety standard. But that's only true for relatively short exposures and not for the continuous condition use that you're going to see in children who are receiving this for the examples that we're showing, which is probably severe aggression and things like that. It's not going to be short-term use. So a major emphasis of pharmacoepi has been finding creative ways to assess long-term safety. And thus, Dr. Bobo and Dr. Cooper, in collaboration with Wayne Ray, have done the kind of study that you were seeing today, which is a really persuasive one, I think. Wayne has been at it for so long, he's plugged all the holes in the models, as far as I can see, and so he's helping us to be able to say with some conviction when we say to our legislators, hey, we think we should be doing something about outcomes research, because this is pretty strong evidence at this point. The third question that I want to raise is, where is the U.S. infrastructure for outcomes research on psychopharm treatment? And so this is, the natural outgrowth of having spent a long time in the utilization of psychotropic meds and seeing those patterns go, as Dr. Dos Reis's graphs showed you, that, you know, they all keep going this way and this way. And so if you look back over 30 years, my God, you know, the graphs are way off the charts. So it seems unlikely, and the three drug combinations have been growing. And there's absolutely no evidence that even if you took three drugs that had been separately evaluated for effectiveness and put them together, the drug-drug interaction picture now is like, I don't know, we'll use it and we'll see how it goes, right? And the real difficulty in psych, compared with other areas, in my view, is that the danger of behavioral toxicity. So what is that? Behavioral toxicity is that I gave you a second drug, okay, to treat some of the new symptoms that I see after the first one, and I don't recognize that it could be the drug itself that is producing this new behavioral pattern. And so it becomes a game of adding one more. And so everything now is moving from, and New York Times on Saturday above the fold. If you've missed it, you could read it, but it's depressing me, so I'll tell you why. Because if you read the headline it says, what does it say? One drug or two? That's his question. It's not if one or if two or what other, the question that you raised earlier, what psychotherapeutic intervention could be added to assure that we are doing this in a balance, right? Your risk-benefit balance. It's not there. Instead, you get, an anecdotal story of a mom and a child living in California under arduous social circumstances, having moved in with the brother and sister of the mother. And so you know it's a high-stress, chaotic environment for this child, and total stress out because the schools don't want them, daycare doesn't want them, nobody wants these children. And so we keep medicating, and the mom is kind of angry, according to the newspaper report, because she's so frustrated that you can't figure out what to do. So she's looking for a pill, or at least a magic formula, to take so that she can get to work, because she can't miss work without risking losing her income. So we've got to get way beyond that, and the infrastructure to get way beyond that, I think, is what I would call adapting the Framingham model. So if you all remember the Framingham study, it was a wonderful cohort study taking on the city of Framingham, Massachusetts, to understand their cardiovascular risk patterns over many, many years. They are still deriving data from the Framingham study. So my suggestion to you is let's create a Framingham for Child Psychopharm, because I don't know how else we are going to sort out the many, many factors that are involved in understanding a child's benefit-risk assessment for a given drug. So that's the essence of my questions and or comments, and now I hope that we can engage people quickly so that I'm not the only one in the room talking.
Thank you, Julie. That was great. That was really... I would just call the discussion topic. Unfortunately, Dr. Bobo had to leave due to clinical responsibilities, but I think we're in good hands with Dr. Cooper for any burning questions over that. I would like to open up... first, I would like to thank our presenters over here, including myself, for really... I think Julie did a very nice job in kind of laying the framework and thinking about an agenda for public health advocacy, research practice, where we want to go from here. And we certainly have an opportunity to then build this into the session for tomorrow. So I just want to open up the floor for any questions or comments.
There's increasing recognition. Some of the APA did some work a couple years ago on making recommendations for safe prescribing, sort of the less is more, and their top five recommendations all had to do with antipsychotics. For children, not using them as first-line agents, not putting people on multiple antipsychotics. So there is some effort afoot to try to provide that, but it's such a delicate balance for a healthcare professional who's facing these issues. The parents of a child with autism who's up all night long every night, where the parents are taking turns because they fear for their safety and for the child's safety. But what's really important to think about is that those are important kids that need treatment. These kids oftentimes that are being placed on these medications, that's not who this is. These are kids with ADHD disruptive in class. And so the really severely affected children, those kind of things. So working with professionals around not just those kids who have clear indications, but where there's marginal indications. And you know, there's certainly one of the more effective ways of intervening with behavior is academic detailing. But that's a pretty labor-intensive way to identify outliers, to address them and bring evidence to them to suggest that their practice is out of line compared to their peers, and then help them to come into line there. That is an effective strategy and one that's worth pursuing, because with data like that Dr. Dostries presented and others, you can begin to identify patterns of prescribing. And this, to go to your issue about the changes in the foster care system. So I receive kids in my clinic all the time from foster care who have been out in other places, and they come with incomplete data. But there are approaches to do that. So Tennessee actually has been doing some amazing work around centers of excellence for children in foster care to ensure better continuity of care. So they show up with data about what's been going on with them. There's medication review, and when there's outliers, intervening to improve that. Sure. Yeah, and I think the point is that there's things within the foster care system itself that leads to some of these issues and some of the challenges that we face, and I think that's a really nice and important observation.
I would just add that thinking about trauma-focused kind of care and being cognizant of that for some of these very young children, I mean, being removed from, regardless of maybe how bad the situation is, being removed from the home of your parents is pretty traumatic, and I think that these kind of very early young years from that removal and working in the context of dealing with some of those issues prior to kind of going down the road. I would also back on what Dr. Cooper said with regard to from the provider perspective, and this you just kind of jogged my memory with these programs that are now being rolled out in many of the states. There is that incentive to kind of go back to the provider and provide either a second opinion consultation or in the clinical review, really kind of understand why a medication is being used. So hopefully as we move forward, we'll see that these rates will change somewhat. The providers are not very happy about some of this contact. It's kind of like, well, you deal with these children. I'm trying to do my best. But not to be facetious, it has been a difficult endeavor to at least roll out some of these plans. But I think we had another question, Mark.
Can you please speak up?
My research is on neonatal abstinence syndrome, so when the mom does drugs, specifically opioids, when she's pregnant, so the baby's born addicted. So, I mean, there is no standardization in that treatment even. There's some guidelines from AAP, and that's really controversial because there's no studies done on what the
No, no, I don't know if you're, I think what you're raising is that the population where we have really just essentially no evidence. I mean, we have very little evidence in pediatric populations, and much of what's being used obviously is being used without an approved indication and in combinations where we don't even have evidence that they work well. But you're talking about now women, pregnant women, and the unborn child and their exposure. And then how do we manage that after the baby's born, who's born addicted? I don't know if you had something you wanted to address on that.
Yeah, I think you bring up an important point. I think neonatal abstinence syndrome is a great example, another example in a sort of another domain of the interface between decisions about sort of treating, in this case, treating the pregnant woman, and then dealing with some of these unintended consequences. So with the antipsychotics, it's the type 2 diabetes and the chronic long-term effects for the mothers, because the data about use of these medications during pregnancy, the opioids, is from heroin from 1970s, and so we don't know about that. So it's again. So I think as we think about, because our time's getting close, it looks like. But as we think about tomorrow's conversation, one easy thing to do would be to throw our hands up and say, "Oh my gosh, what on earth are we going to do? These kids are on these antipsychotics. They're setting fires. There's terrible things happening." It's absolutely true. There are things these challenges facing. But as public health professionals and those of you who engage in research or you engage in policy or delivery or teaching, what you can do is something every day, something that's going to help move this forward. And so the work that's been presented here today are contributions to the literature that allow us to understand more. As a result of these two or three studies that we shared with today, we know more about antipsychotics in kids than we did a year ago. So we've got to do something. And so it does get really daunting, but if you just sort of take it a step at a time, we can make a difference for these kids.
Game that if it isn't randomized and it didn't come out of FDA mandate, then then it's not good enough, right? So observational methods like you see here, like from Dr. Wayne Ray, those are all examples of how people could be moving. We are moving, but that inter too takes now big advocacy from us, you know, in whatever ways you can. Simon, we have to hear from you before we're thrown out of here.
I really appreciate this because I'm coming from a position, I think, here of kids and adults. I see people coming in with on some of these drugs, and I see the effects of, for example, the diabetes issue. I see a lot of adolescents now that are getting affected by diabetes, some of whom may be on these medications. And I'm like, what can we do about this? But then we have that conflict with their situation and how the family has to deal with some of the issues of their behavior patterns. Fortunately, in an urban setting, I'm in Chicago, Cook County, we have some resources, probably more than a rural setting, which is hard for them. Because even then, though, people have a hard time getting to our clinic, even if it's in an urban setting, just in terms of transportation issues. So, maybe the answer might be visiting psychiatrists or some. I mean, something that I would love to visit my patients in their homes because I can find a lot of information that way. But unfortunately, it's not an option for me in my clinical situation now. But I think that's something that would be helpful.
Right.
Assessing that. So,
well, Susan's colleague has navigators.
Right.
You might
mention
that.
Right. We are past 4 o'clock, but I'm happy to stay and continue this discussion for folks. A colleague at University of Maryland, and this the family navigation program is really not novel to our state, but others have really used this model for. It is a peer of the family that can help kind of navigate some of these issues. And the issue of, my lights are going to get turned off or I don't have food to feed my child tomorrow are really critical things that they become competing alternatives of what do I do next. And so those might be another opportunity if states can actually provide funding to have a navigation service available to families in need as part of the larger kind of Medicaid budget. That would be one way to kind of overcome some of these barriers that become system barriers. And when you have 3 or 4 children that you need to also bring with you to that appointment, the bus fare becomes unmanageable and you can't get into a cab because you have too many people. And so the transportation, and you can't pay for childcare. So these are real life problems that really kind of get in the way. And I think this was a really great session to start thinking about really, we talk about regional variation, but I think we have to understand the underpinning and the clinical context and what's going on in practice to then be able to say, okay, now let's look at this nationally and what have we found nationally across various states in terms of the variability in psychotropic use among pediatric populations. And so tomorrow's session, we can really kind of continue this discussion. And hopefully people will attend tomorrow at 12:30 because we will take this up looking at empirical studies that have looked at national data sets and one in a very young population. So the themes will carry over. And I like the questions that have been posed because I think we're talking about, what should we be advocating for in terms of research? How can we really advocate for the needs in the practice settings? And what kind of policies should we really be kind of helping? So this, as we do this work, does it just end up in publications in a journal, or can we really help
right.
them hit where the rubber meets the road, per se? And so it would be great to really kind of continue that tomorrow in the session. So
can I say the name of the room?
It's 348, so, and it's at 12:30 to 2, and you'll see Jennifer and you'll see Dr. Kirby there as well, too, and Lauren. So, thank you very much for your time.